This is Michael McCusker. Good morning. I'd like to read a few things, a bit of a potpourri, you might say. And I'd like to begin with a commentary by Michael Moore that he wrote, be an op-ed, I guess, for the New York Times. The Obamacare We Deserve. 2014 marks the beginning of health care coverage under the Affordable Care Act's new insurance exchanges, for which 2 million Americans have signed up. Now that the individual mandate is officially here, let me begin with an admission. Obamacare is awful. That is the dirty little secret many liberals have avoided saying out loud for fear of aiding the president's enemies at a time when the ideal of universal health care needed all the support it could get. Unfortunately, this meant that instead of blaming companies like Novartis, which charges leukemia patients $90,000 annually for the drug Gleevec, or health insurance chief executives like Stephen Hemsley of United Health Group, who made nearly $102 million in 2009 for the sky-high price of American health care, the president's Democratic supporters bought into the myth that it was all those people going to get free colonoscopies and chemotherapy for the fun of it. I believe Obamacare's rocky start, clueless planning, a lousy website, insurance companies raising rates, and the president's telling people they could keep their coverage when, in fact, not all could, is a result of one fatal flaw. The Affordable Care Act is a pro-insurance industry plan implemented by a president who knew in his heart that a single-payer, Medicare for All model was the true way to go. When right-wing critics expose, and that's a quote, the fact that President Obama endorsed a single-payer system before 2004, they are actually telling the truth. What we now call Obamacare was conceived at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank, and birthed in Massachusetts by Mitt Romney, then the governor. The president took RomneyCare, a program designed to keep the private insurance industry intact, and just improved some of its provisions. In effect, the president was simply trying to put lipstick on the dog in the carrier on top of Mitt Romney's car. And we knew it. By 2017, we will be funneling over $100 billion annually to private insurance companies. You can be sure they'll use some of that to try to privatize Medicare. For many people, the affordable part of the Affordable Care Act risks being a cruel joke. The cheapest plan available to a 60-year-old couple making $65,000 a year in Hartford, Connecticut, will cost $11,800 in annual premiums, and their deductible will be $12,600. If both become seriously ill, they might have to pay almost $25,000 in a single year. Pre-Obamacare, they could have bought insurance that was cheaper, but much worse, potentially with unlimited out-of-pocket costs. And yet, I would be remiss if I did not say this. Obamacare is a godsend. My friend Donna Smith, who was forced to move into her daughter's spare room at age 52 because health problems bankrupted her and her husband Larry, now has cancer again. As she undergoes treatment, at least she won't be in terror of losing coverage and becoming uninsurable. Under Obamacare, her premium has been cut in half to $456 per month. Let's not take a victory lap yet, but build on what is there to get what we deserve, universal quality health care. Those who live in red states need the benefit of Medicaid expansion. It may have seemed like smart politics in the short run for Republican governors to grab the opportunity offered by the Supreme Court rulings that made Medicaid expansion optional for states. But it was long-term stupid. If those 20 states hold out, they will eventually lose an estimated total of $20 billion in federal funds per year, money that would be going to hospitals and treatment. In blue states, let's lobby for a public option on the insurance exchange, a health plan run by the state government rather than a private insurer. In Massachusetts, State Senator James B. Eldridge is trying to pass a law that would set one up. Some counties in California are also trying it. Montana came up with another creative solution. Governor Brian Schweitzer, a Democrat who just completed two terms, set up several health clinics to treat state workers with no co-pays and no deductibles. The doctors there are salaried employees of the state of Montana. Their only goal is their patients' health. If this sounds too much like big government to you, you might like to know that Google, Cisco, and Pepsi do exactly the same. All eyes on Vermont's plan for a single-payer system starting in 2017. If it flies, it will change everything, with many states sure to follow suit by setting up their own versions. That's why corporate money will soon flood into Vermont to crush it. The legislators who will go to the mat for this will need all the support they can get. If you live east of the Mississippi, look up the bus schedule to Montpelier. So let's get started. Obamacare can't be fixed by its namesake. It's up to us to make it happen. And that's by Michael Moore, The Obamacare We Deserve. And, of course, he's a documentary filmmaker whose 2007 film, Sicko, examined the American healthcare industry. And speaking with the health sector, another article written late last year by Stephen Rosenfeld. And it was published on Alternet. Top Obamacare surprise in 2013, starting with health sector's greed. Beyond the GOP's efforts to overturn or cripple Obamacare, the wobbly rollout of the largest new government safety net in decades has led to some surprising revelations about health care in America. Most surprising is how many stubbornly greedy players there are in the medical industrial complex. The foremost example is how the middlemen, insurers, have seized every opportunity to gouge the public before and after insurance buying exchanges opened this past October 1st. Not only did premiums jump by double-digit amounts from coast to coast for many policyholders after the law's passage in 2009, but this fall the industry doubled down and jacked up or canceled policies for hundreds of thousands of people. That's quite a way to say thank you to the federal government for sending them millions of new customers. But insurers are not the only greedy sector. Hospitals, many of which are chartered as nonprofits and get tax breaks, have been unmasked by astute reporters for shamelessly overcharging for just about anything that can be put in a bill. The New York Times reported that after a backyard fall, a leading San Francisco hospital charged $2,930 and $1,696, respectively, for three stitches and a dab of skin glue. The Times's detailed piece said, "There is little science to how hospitals determine the prices they print on hospital bills." The same point could be made about the prescription drug industry and pharmacy chains, where the retail price on labels is off the charts and bears no relation to copays. And there's also the not exactly compassionate decision by hospitals and doctors to reject patients under Obamacare via the new state or federal exchanges. That echoes physicians refusing to take Medicaid patients, saying government reimbursements are insufficient. It's no surprise that the GOP is blaming Obama for everything that keeps going wrong in America's profit-driven healthcare system. But it is surprising that these brash business decisions are being thrust upon the public with impunity, where the blame game is to tar President Obama with everything the public sector was going to do anyway and has been doing. Obviously, the Obamacare website's wobbly rollout was the administration's fault, but there are some dimensions to that story that have not been appreciated. First is the surprisingly decrepit state of government's information technology outside spy agencies. People who work with government always find different computer systems, outdated machines, and incompatible software across counties, states, and federal agencies. To get them to smoothly work together is a giant task. and signing up for health care is more complex than registering to vote. Moreover, the firms that know how to get big federal contracts often don't deliver what they promise on time. Add to that the refusal by red state governors to help the feds set up insurance exchanges by sharing their data on residents, and the botched rollout is not surprising, especially since federal agencies have been run on the cheap for years by Congress. If anything, the over-reliance on the private sector for Obamacare builds an even stronger case for a fully public system. Finally, another surprise about Obamacare is the GOP's determination to destroy a private sector initiative that was proposed by one of its own think tanks, the Heritage Foundation. The Supreme Court will decide this year if businesses don't have to offer contraceptive services under their health plans because of the owner's religious objections. Another GOP-led lawsuit is trying to stop premium subsidies in states that haven't created insurance marketplaces. And there is no shortage of GOP candidates who keep promising to repeal the law if elected. Despite the partisan rancor, frustrating website and premium hikes, people are slowly but steadily signing up for Obamacare because they need health care. But that's not a surprise. And that was Top Obamacare Surprises, Starting with Healthcare Sector's Greed, by Stephen Rosenfeld. And it was by Alternet on the net. Now I'd like to change a little bit course, but it still has to do with money. As a matter of fact, it's called Life Versus Money by Stephen Burke, and it's in the January Fish. It's his regular column. The most salient characteristic of our time, is a reduction of all life to commodities for sale on markets. The earth, which our ancient forebears revered as their mother, is now merely the basis of corporate and banking self-enrichment. The corporate feudal powers that be view the earth merely as so much dead matter to be ripped apart. Whether by open pit or strip mining to recover increasingly rare metals, drilling miles deep offshore wells running ever greater risk of massive spills, injecting toxic chemicals into the earth or ripping the tops off mountains, all to continue the present fossil fuel, high-tech economy, transnational corporations and the banks that financing them are daily consuming and destroying more and more of the planet that is our carbon heritage. In the 1980s, I used to watch the documentaries of oceanographer Jacques Cousteau as he and his sons dove deep to study sea life and observe the far-flung toxic effects of industrial civilization upon the oceans. They noted that coral reefs, the mothers of all aquatic life, are dying, and Cousteau prophesied that if the effluence of industrialism continues unchecked, the seas that surround and nourish us and all aquatic life will be dead within 50 years. As the oceans acidify due to the influx of carbonic acid due to global warming, we are right on schedule to fulfill Cousteau's dire prediction. Yet, as we look about us at day-to-day life, we see mainly business as usual. No sense of urgency pervades the nation or the world. Conferences conducted under the auspices of the United Nations Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change produce hollow verbiage, not even a carbon tax. Why are the powers that be in such lethal denial? Why do they continue daily, yearly pursuing, even ramping up the hypercapitalism that is so toxic to the very continuance of complex and intelligent life on this planet? The culprit is in the worldwide single-minded pursuit of money. Money is the sole driving force behind the world system. At the start of the Christian era, Jesus said, "You cannot love God and money," or mammon, a false god. His brother, known as James the Just, said, "The love of money is the root of all evil." These passages and many like them are all in the New Testaments that line the backs of church pews and shelves of Christian bookstores. Yet how often is a sinful love of money the subject of a sermon? I know of no contemporary pastor or theologian who speaks or writes of the utterly corrosive effect of money on all planetary life. far more than a medium of exchange. Money possesses an uncanny power to wholly preoccupy individuals and their societies. Today's capitalism makes money its god, long having dethroned the god of creation or nature, that is, of life itself. Money, by turning every resource of a living planet into a dead commodity for sale on a market, thereby turns all life into death. This is especially true in a system like the present one, which makes monetary accumulation the be-all and end-all of the structures that rule the world. From that single-minded focus on accumulation comes the inability to see that it is the cause of the utter destruction of life on Earth. Preoccupation with getting money operates to continuously derail the people who make decisions at all levels from choosing the nurturance and enhancement of life. At the local level, we can see this process at work in the Astoria City Council's recent decision, with only Drew Herzig's dissent, to sell off a sizable portion of its forest land to private developers. The city's wild places are not only an object of unique beauty, they are also habitat for a great many non-human species, including deer, raccoons, possums, frogs, and songbirds. Our wildlife experts, and that's a quote, sternly warn us against feeding these animals. But deprived of forest habitat, how are these creatures supposed to survive? They won't, as they have not been all over the anthropocentric world, where humans relentlessly impose an economy of death, killing hundreds of species daily, all for the love of money. And that was Life Versus Money by Stephen Burke in the January Ipfish, published here, right here in Astoria, Oregon. Now I'd like to read something that I published in my newspaper a number of years ago, the North Coast Times Eagle, by Jeremy Seabrook, who wrote the article originally for Third World Network Features, which is an independent news service in Penang, Malaysia. The Tyranny of Money. Absolute poverty has declined from 70% in 1960 to almost 30% today, says a television advertisement for care. But there is a problem with most definitions of poverty. It is common for humanitarians to cite the fact that there are 1 billion people in the world who live on less than a dollar a day. This fact is cited as proof of unspeakable deprivations. But life with zero income does not have to be degrading if people can provide all their own needs for themselves. On the other hand, an income of $25,000 may be called poverty when all needs must be purchased and the sum is insufficient for the purpose. To recreate poverty in the image of the West as a monetary sum, the absence of which means you're poor, is perhaps the most effective way of setting the whole world on the same developmental path, for it means that the norms of the market economy are being universalized. Once measures of wealth and poverty that depend on money have been accepted, the poor are condemned to an eternity of poverty. In the market economy, people must learn how to be poor. What social reformers are really saying when they cite people living on less than a dollar a day is that they were excluded from the market economy. The idea that this, in and of itself, is an index of poverty is the profound untruth that lies beneath all money-dominated statistics and measures of poverty. Another way of looking at those who have not yet entered the market economy is to say they remain free and independent of market-provided needs and commodities. So to declare a 40% reduction in the number of absolute poor, when you are really saying there has been such a reduction in the numbers living, surviving, existing comfortably outside the market system, is to create unnecessary confusion. This is the real scandal. All those still living outside the market economy give the lie to the totalizing thrust of globalization, the imperatives of conforming to one particular way of answering need. There is a word for this. It is tyranny. The struggle to establish the uncontested dominance of the world market has been the true locus of attack upon not only the poor of the earth, but all those whose way of life is to reproach this market economy. The struggle has been a kind of low-intensity warfare. Its battle cry has been development. Its weaponry has been money. Its foot soldiers, the high-consuming middle class that has emerged in virtually every country. At the same time, a distinctly more aggressive war has been carried on against those people who still occupy forests, coastal environments, subsistence farms, and riverbanks, and whose resources, minerals, metals, timber, fish, water, must be surrendered to the market. In the name of bringing these people into the 21st century, they have been systematically dispossessed, violently removed from ancestral lands. In India, in the more than 50 years since independence, 25 million people have been displaced for infrastructural of developmental projects. The market offers instruction in being poor. First, it removes from individuals and groups of people the capacity to provide for their own needs and the needs of others, and it creates dependency. Second, the market teaches us about what we do not have. Through self-reliance, we learn what we need, and that is surprisingly little. Through the market, we learn what we might get. In that sense, the market serves the growing self-consciousness of an industrialized humanity that must now understand that all the familiar artifacts and goods of traditional culture are actually junk, and that everything that is produced elsewhere has superior value, set by its monetary price. In this way, inferiorization, subordination, and dependency are the principal gifts of the market to self-reliance. The market economy sets all humanity in a sad and circular dance, a chase of perpetual keeping up with an abstraction, the limitlessness of desire. All human societies have recognized the infinity of human desire, and they have taught that wisdom lies in recognizing the impossibility of pursuing it. And that was The Tyranny of Money by Jeremy Seabrook, who wrote this article for Third World Network Features, which, again, is an independent news service in Penang, Malaysia, and was reprinted in the North Coast Times Eagle in October 1998. Rings a clear bell, doesn't it? I should think, anyway. And I'd like to read three shocking ways in which inequality keeps getting worse in America by Paul Buchelt, also as an earlier article published on the internet, on Alternet. Someone reviewing the data is likely to conclude that there must be some mistake. It doesn't seem possible that one out of 20 American families could each have made $1 million since Obama became president, while millions of American families' net worth is barely recovered. But the evidence comes from numerous reputable sources. Some conservatives continue to claim that President Obama is unfriendly to business. But the facts show that the richest Americans and the biggest businesses have been the biggest beneficiaries of the massive wealth gain over the past 5 years. Number one, $5 million to each of the 1% and $1 million to each of the next 4%. From the end of 2008 to the middle of 2013, total U.S. wealth increased from $47 trillion to $72 trillion. About $16 trillion of that is financial gain, stocks and other financial instruments. The richest 1% own about 38% of stocks and half of non-stock financial assets. So they've gained at least $6.1 trillion, 38% of $16 trillion. That's over $5 million for each of 1.2 million households. The next richest 4%, based on similar calculations, gained about $5.1 trillion. That's over $1 million for each of their 4.8 million households. The least wealthy 90% in our country own only 11% of all stocks, excluding pensions, which are fast disappearing. The frantic recent surge in the stock market has largely bypassed these families. Two, evidence of our growing wealth inequality. This first fact is nearly ungraspable. In 2009, the average wealth for almost half of American families was zero. Their debt exceeded their assets. In 1983, the families in America's poorer half owned an average of about $15,000. But from 1983 to 1989, median wealth fell from over $70,000 to about $60,000. From 1998 to 2009, fully 80% of Americans lost wealth. They had to borrow to stay afloat. It seems the disparity couldn't get much worse, but after the recession, it did. According to a Pew Research Center study, in the first 2 years of recovery, the mean net worth of households in the upper 7% of the wealth distribution rose by an estimated 28%, while the mean net worth of households in the lower 93% dropped by 4%. And then from 2011 to 2013, the stock market grew by almost 50%, with again the great majority of that gain going to the richest 5%. Today, our wealth gap is worse than that of the third world. Out of all developed and undeveloped countries with at least 250,000 adults, the United States has the fourth highest degree of wealth inequality in the world, trailing only Russia, Ukraine, and Lebanon. 3. Congress's solution, take from the poor. Congress has responded by cutting unemployment benefits and food stamps, along with other sequester targets like Meals on Wheels for seniors and Head Start for preschoolers. The more the super rich make, the more they seem to believe in the cruel fantasy that the poor are to blame for their own struggles. President Obama recently proclaimed that inequality drives everything I do in this office, quote unquote. Indeed it may, but in the wrong direction. And that was Three Shocking Ways Inequality Keeps Getting Worse in America by Paul Buchheit. And that was on Alternet, on the net. And this has been Michael McCusker. And if certain disasters don't occur to me personally, such as maybe being hit by a swarm of drones carrying packages, I shall be here next Thursday at approximately this time.